Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Who is Alex Trebek show. And unfortunately, this popular game show host has developed pancreatic cancer. So that will be, in essence, the final Jeopardy answer.
Who won it? Boy, I hate that.
Yeah. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, special radio wave to the MSU Ronald G. Eglin Space Science Center staff. Shelly Irving is away this week.
What'd you do to her this time?
Apparently a large sinkhole has opened next to the Isonville Zoo.
Are we going to be talking about sinkholes today?
And we had to have somebody on the scene.
Didn't one open up in Kentucky this week?
Well, now see, I come from the karst area close to Bowling Green, and sinkholes are open there all the time. I mean, it's just a 24-hour-a-day open sinkhole.
So what you're saying is you're special.
I just say I am very familiar with sinkholes.
You are legendary.
Now that he has paid proper obeisance, he's now from the University of Kentucky, the Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, to talk about our web presence, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the show at WMKY.org. That's right. Moorhead State Public Radio's website. Find the Health Matters link. It's buried in there somewhere. There's a menu system, and I'd tell you what it is, but they change it from time to time, so... Anyway, once you find it, bookmark the Health Matters page, go straight to it, get a list of the shows, get a little short summary on each show. There's a list of show summaries, but most importantly, there is a link to the MP3 file, the recording, the holy grail of Health Matters. You can listen to it over and over and over. And if you're like some radio networks, you can use us as filler and we can fill up an entire week's worth of airtime.
Absolutely.
That's exactly what we can do. We can be filler like nobody's business.
But I tell you what, Rick.
So, again, go to the Moorhead State Public Radio website, WMKY.org, to listen to the show. After that, you've become infuriated. You absolutely have to vent. Your two-way mechanism, the interactive way to get a hold of the show, is facebook.com/HMRadioShow. That is a fan page. Go in there, leave us a comment, leave us some feedback. Let us know what you think, what you don't like, what show topics you want to hear about. If your radio network wants to use us as filler, that's a great place to start the conversation. It is, in fact, an interactive way to get a hold of the cast and crew. If you want to find it, go to facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
Our sponsor for today's show, 8 key facts about pancreatic cancer.
And why not 9? Did you whittle down?
I ran out of facts.
Did you whittle down?
Key facts. No, this I had to put these together from several different sites.
So these are Tony's 8 facts.
Yes. Well,
Found facts.
Yeah, I found them. I copied
you
them.
Googled them. You used the Google.
I used the Google. Fun fact number 1. The pancreas lies behind the stomach in front of the spine. It works to help the body use and store energy from food. And it has really 2 functions. There's one we call the endocrine function that produces hormones such as insulin that controls your blood sugar levels. It also makes digestive enzymes, and that's where the pancreatitis comes from. If the pancreas gets inflamed, those digestive enzymes unfortunately run amok, and they digest part of the pancreas and also the tissues around it. It runs along the top part of your abdomen, behind your stomach, behind your colon. An epigastric, a upper abdominal pain, that is fairly constant is a sign of pancreatitis or, for that matter, pancreatic cancer. Key fact number 2, there are different types of pancreatic cancer. Keeping in mind the function of the pancreas, the endocrine part that makes hormones, the exocrine part that makes the digestive juices. There are endocrine or exocrine tumors, and the tumors act differently. About 94% of the pancreatic cancers are exocrine tumors. They come from those digestive cells. That's called an adenocarcinoma. 6% neuroendocrine tumors grow more slowly. Steve Jobs had, in fact, a neuroendocrine tumor of his pancreas. Key fact number 3, more than 55,000 Americans will be diagnosed with pancreatic cancer this year, men and women affected equally. And key fact number 4, pancreatic cancer has the lowest survival rate of all cancers. Just 3 to 6% are diagnosed survive for more than 5 years. Survival has improved for most cancers over the last 40 years, but not for pancreatic cancer. Death rates are increasing. The incidence appears to be increasing, while most other cancers, in fact, the death rates are decreasing. So this is a very, very difficult cancer to treat. The only shot you have really at a cure is to pick it up early when it can be removed. But since it's sitting in a large cavity, the abdomen, usually you are completely unaware that you have a problem until it has gotten big.
It's usually gotten symptomatic before you actually, right. And that's, you know, you obviously want to screen and catch something before it's symptomatic.
Yeah, the two tough cancers of our generation have been lung cancer and pancreatic cancer. Lung cancer number one on cancer deaths, and pancreatic cancer top five. And in each case, they can get pretty big before they cause any symptoms, so you just don't really think about them. You're not aware that you're having problems. The problem with pancreatic cancer is anyone can get it, and we just don't have a screening test right now that's effective. So, unfortunately, we lose a lot of people.
And again, with lung cancer, you end up having to do basically X-rays, right? I mean, and, yeah. But I mean, with lung cancer, you can kind of screen smokers, right? So you know kind of who to
right.
go after.
If you have a smoker,
the population
55 to 77, who has been smoking for more than 30 years and who has quit less than 15 years, they are the highest risk. If you limit your screening to those smokers, then you've got a pretty good chance of detecting it. And the lungs also, they're more uniform. You know, again, you've got lung tissue. And then you got the chest wall and, of course, your heart in the middle. The pancreas sits in a bunch of tissue. A small tumor will not show up as easily as it would in the lung. And also, it affects absolutely everyone, is at some risk for it. There are a few risk factors, but really nothing that you can hang your hat on. And so we would have to screen everyone. And that is, again, about 27% of the population smoking right now. They are not all long-term smokers. So the numbers you have to screen are at least four times greater for pancreatic cancer. And the screening test is not going to be as easy to do.
Well,
review.
I mean, first you have to develop the screening test.
Right.
Then you got to test everybody.
Chemotherapy, not so good. They have not made the kind of advances that they made against some other types of cancer using the new biologics, using genetic sequencing, all those things that we use for other cancers just have not led to the improvements that you see with the other cancer and survival.
To some extent, that's because it's by the time it's detected, it's pretty far gone. I mean,
yeah.
And so, I mean, we don't really, I mean, I would think that if you caught that early, you might actually be able to do something with chemo. It might not be quite as developed.
By all accounts, Alex Trebek, a reasonably healthy person, was diagnosed with stage four. Stage four means that it is already metastasized to other parts of his body. So case in point there. My wife made the point. She said, I told her, you know, it affects men and women equally. But when you look at the celebrities who have pancreatic cancer, most of the ones that you think about are men. There are some women who have had pancreatic cancer. Joan Crawford had pancreatic cancer, I believe, if I remember correctly. But the celebrities that have had it, predominantly men. Trebek made the announcement back March 7th. He said, I normally the prognosis is not very encouraging, and we certainly give that a hearty amen here at Health Matters. But Trebek says, I'm going to fight this. I plan to beat the low survival rate statistics for this disease. I wish him well. I think.
I mean, you know, we're talking about Alex Trebek, but, you know, obviously I'm a techie. You know, this was a Steve Jobs thing, right? I mean, this is Apple. This is the guy who created the iPhone.
Right. Well, what do you say? 56,000 diagnosed, 45,000 die every year. Almost always strikes after age 45. 71 is the average age at diagnosis. Alex Trebek's 78,
right,
by the way. Family history and genetics, but you have to have a first-degree relative that had it. It does not run heavily in families. Tobacco use does make a difference. Obesity, workplace exposure to chemicals, especially dry cleaning, metalworking, and also if you have chronic irritation of the pancreas, chronic pancreatitis, higher rates of cancer as well. So, again, our sympathies, prayers go to Alex Trebek. And as he begins to settle into this, I still remember Peter Jennings. Michael Landon, Greg is showing me those.
Yeah,
of us who are
Aretha
older.
Franklin.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's a bunch, Tony. I mean, yeah. Really, just a quick search. I mean, there's just a Jack Benny. boy, you got to be our age to know that, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at any rate, he has a difficult thing. Peter Jennings, the news anchor, died of lung cancer, and he vowed that he would report back on his fight with lung cancer, and he was going to continue on the job. And then he signed off and disappeared. He just never, ever came back on the air again. So I wish Alex Trebek well. My suspicion is, if it acts the way it usually acts, his time on Jeopardy will be very limited from here on out.
Absolutely. And, I don't know. It's just tragic, Tony. I mean, that one of all the cancers, it's rare. Matter of fact, I can't say that I've ever heard of a positive outcome. And I hate to say that because it's just rare. I mean, you yourself said, I think the 5-year mortality rate was, 16%?
Yeah. 5-year survival rate, 16%. They're giving it lower than that in the article that I just read. But in general, it is bad. Now, I think what they're saying is for stage 4, in other words, if it has already spread,
but and you're fighting with chemotherapy. Stage 4, right? I mean, it's always caught there.
I have one patient that looks like he's going to survive it because they were running a CAT scan, I think, for a kidney stone or something.
And
just
caught
it. Yeah. But that's a rare thing.
Do you think there'll be a time where the physicians will eventually just say, look, anytime I'm doing anything in the abdomen, I'm going to go ahead and screen for the pancreas? Just so you, because I mean, otherwise you won't, there's no way to get it.
That's true. The problem is right now we just don't have enough information about early detection to make that work. I will tell you, if you're over age 50 and you have any problem at all with your bowels, we're going to do a colonoscopy because we know that will save your life. It will pick up a colon cancer early.
I guess I'm
we
just thinking
know.
Because they're in there. They're already in there.
Yeah, but we just don't know that doing that actually is beneficial. This has just been a very, very difficult disease to make any progress
against.
Well,
let's be honest. We don't solve anything on health matters.
Nope. We will most of the time, we're just kind of sad. We're sad now because we've got to take a break. We'll come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. Boy, Tony, I had, we took such a long break, I had to remember where I was. But this is, in fact, the second fractional portion of Health Matters, and I am, in fact, Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the
legendary.
Alex Trebek. I got such grief. I thought, I'm just going to work this in. I'm going to keep working on it. This is going to be my project for the next several months, is to try to establish that I am purportedly, allegedly, rumored to be legendary.
Oh, no. Hey, you are legendary, just not for the reasons you hope.
At any rate, this is the Who Is Alex Trebek show. The question to the answer, this popular game show host has been recently diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, which leads to our 8 key facts on pancreatic cancer. Key fact number 1, the pancreas lies behind the stomach in front of the spine. It has 2 functions. One is it makes hormones such as insulin that helps you store your food. It also makes the digestive juices that digest the food in the gut. Key fact number 2, there are several different types of pancreatic cancer, but the main types are endocrine tumors, which come from those cells that make insulin. They're called neuroendocrine tumors, or there is the exocrine, that's the main cells in the body of the pancreas that make the digestive juices. Unfortunately, we are speculating, and we don't know. We don't have access to medical records, but we're speculating with it being stage 4, and that is by far and away, 94% of the time, the most common form of pancreatic cancer that Alex Trebek probably has that one. Steve Jobs did have a neuroendocrine, which is a little bit slower growing. Key fact number 3, more than 55,000 Americans will be diagnosed. 45,000 will die this year of pancreatic cancer. Key fact number 4, lowest survival rate of all cancers, 3-6% of those diagnosed survive for 5 years, and it is not improving over the last 40 years. With all the advances we've made in genetic analysis and chemotherapy in supportive care, we have not really made a dent in our mortality for pancreatic cancer. Key fact number five, it is the 10th most common cancer in the United States. It is the fourth deadliest, and it may pass breast cancer and become the third leading cause in the next few years. Key fact number six, studies show that not smoking, drinking alcohol in moderation so that you don't irritate the pancreas in the first place, maintaining a healthy body weight can reduce your risk. It increases as you age. Nearly 90% of patients are older than 55. Average age is 72. Key fact number seven, it is considered hereditary in a small number of cases. 5 to 10% are hereditary or familial. If you have two or more first-degree relatives, that's mother, father, sister, brother, who have had pancreatic cancer, or if you have a certain types of cancer syndromes, you may have an increased risk. Unfortunately, early diagnosis is key. If you're diagnosed in time for surgery, the chance of surviving 5 years goes up 10 times. Unfortunately, that rarely happens. It's nearly always diagnosed too late. 80% of pancreatic cancer patients having terminal disease, average life expectancy 4 to 6 months.
Wow.
And unfortunately, I think that's what Alex Trebek is looking at. He is going to fight that. You can see how well he does. And key fact number eight, the symptoms can be very vague and depend on where the tumor is. As I've mentioned, the pancreas goes across the top part of the abdomen. Abdominal pain, about 70% of the time. Jaundice, again, because of backup of bilirubin in your system, occurs about 50% of the time. So those are our key and very, very, I've got to say, this is just dismal facts.
Yeah, who brought this topic on the show?
Well, you got to talk about what you got to talk about. You know, if we're talking about health, we're not winning many battles these days. So, you know, we tend to be gloomy, but in a cheerful way. You know, we because of our male stupidity,
legendary presence,
we can laugh our way through some pretty horrific stuff. The way it is,
which is really something we should be sad for.
I'm not going to let you get me down because we're happy about things that are not shouldn't be.
We're happy when we know it, or we're happy when, how's that go?
No. All right, next up. There you go.
Right?
This was from Becker's Hospital Review. Kelly Gooch wrote it Monday, February 4th, and I just kept it thinking about when I wanted to talk about it.
Well, technically, you forgot time. All those other times.
Yeah, it's true. It's been in the back.
You left it on your desk.
It's been in the green room waiting to come on.
It's over on the corner of your desk. You don't look at
it. And it's not that good a piece, but I thought it would be.
So you saved it when it's just the two of us.
Yeah, well.
So you can blame me.
We have been through the good stuff, so we got to
get
to
this. Maybe Shelley could have done a better job with this.
Maybe so. This is the American Hospital Association. These are the, there were 19, and that's why it annoys me a little bit. There were 19 threats to rural health care. Challenges affecting rural communities. And some of them we're going to go through fast. Some of them we'll sit down and talk a little bit. But,
we're already sitting.
Yeah, true. We'll sit down and talk about all of them, but we'll talk faster on some than others. How about that? So emerging challenges.
Are we getting ready to play like some kind of buzzword bingo?
Well, okay, sure.
Okay.
Opioid epidemic.
I just need to get my card out here.
Now let me, I just want to explain something that, because this may bother some of our radio fans. It did bother me. Opioid is a hard word to say.
Opioid.
It starts,
pretty good at it.
It gets, well, I am a professional, but still, it does get on your nerves.
Technically, you're not getting paid to say that right
That's
now.
That's true. We used to call them narcotics. You know, these were...
Because those are easy to say.
Yeah, but the problem with narcotics is narcotics are really things that make you sleep. And while the opioids can make you sleep, they are derivatives of opium coming from poppies. And by the way, I can't tell you how many marijuana supporters talk to me about how marijuana is a natural product and there are receptors for it in the brain, so God meant for us to have it. And you can say the exact same thing about opioids, except they kill people because you have receptors for them in your brain. That's why you like them. They come from poppy plants, which are wonderful little flowers. I mean, marijuana doesn't even have decent flowers, right?
You seem to know an awful lot about marijuana.
You know, I just don't. Marijuana is not in any way superior to anything else. I hope it's safer. I don't know. We're about to find out, aren't we? We'll stop there because, like I said, this piece.
We're
going to
sit down and talk about this.
We're going to talk about this for a second because I've been watching this. Now, here was my reasoning on this. You know, we have in Kentucky religious. A very strong religious influence in our state. It has kept some of our counties dry. And if you are in the rest of the United States, you may not be aware of this, but dry means that liquor sales are not allowed in that county. In some cases, liquor is not sold by the drink. You can purchase it in bulk at a a liquor store or somewhere like that. But that is partly because we have a great deal of fundamentalist religion, religious organizations in the state, and they campaigned very hard for this, and they felt that the alcohol was immoral. When the lottery came out, they campaigned very hard against the lottery. When we looked at the possibility of casino, when we look at the possibility of betting, sports betting.
Or horse racing.
On horse races, yeah, as well. Our church lobby came out, and they expressed their moral concern about these things. And they had a great deal of influence. Now, as I reasoned through this, I thought Kentucky would be one of the last states to get to legalize marijuana. I did not count on the approach that the marijuana proponents took of medical marijuana. When we were looking at this, and this was moving up the West Coast, we looked at medical marijuana. And medical marijuana, simply, you go to someone who is a licensed physician or a licensed decider, and you tell them that you have one of a list of diseases, anything from glaucoma to fibromyalgia to insomnia to different things, and they give you a buyer's card. Once you get the buyer's card, then whoever that so-called healthcare provider is, they're out. You take your card, you buy a certain amount of marijuana, you smoke it any way that you wish or prepare it any way that you wish, and they do not monitor your health. They do not assess for response. They do not counsel you regarding it. They simply certify that you have that condition, and you get your buyer's card. So in California, the primary care physicians, the medical establishment, has nothing to do with this. You get your cards online. You go to an online service,
right,
and they'll give you your buyer's card. Cleveland Clinic, Ohio, decided to legalize medical marijuana, and the Cleveland Clinic publicly declared, "We're not going to be involved in this. We are going to limit what we do to things that we know scientifically something about, and this is not a scientific treatment. There is no dosing. There is no assessment of response. We're not monitoring anything." So the Cleveland Clinic was out, and I expect many physicians in Ohio will follow suit. The one thing I didn't count on, though, is by creating this kind of medical aura to the whole thing, they were able to basically keep the church members in their pews. And so I have not seen a hue and cry from our many religious organizations in the state of Kentucky about the possibility of legalizing medical marijuana. And it looks like it's got a pretty good shot at passage when we are recording this show. You will know by the time you hear this show whether we are correct or not, but it looks to me like that it's got a lot of momentum. And I did not anticipate that the churches would back off because they attached a medical label to it. In my mind, I mean, marijuana may turn out to be a great thing. It may turn out to be a good thing. It may turn out to be a bad thing, or all three.
Can we say, in a smokable form, it will never be a great thing? I mean, there is no way, shape, or form that burning leaves in your lungs is a good idea.
Health Matters' first rule of pulmonology: anything you set fire to and put in your mouth is bad for your lungs.
Exactly.
Anything that burns can immediately cause damage to your lungs and also long term.
So I think saying marijuana is a good. I think, you know, what is it? The was it THC? Is that what it is?
Yeah, THC.
The THC component of it may prove to be medically superior to some other treatments, but lighting leaves on fire and then inhaling the smoke, I don't care what's in that smoke, it's not going to outweigh what it's doing, the damage it's doing
right
to your lungs.
I'll say it again, it may turn out to be better. People say, well, look, and they are quite right, I will give you this. They said the opioids that you doctors prescribe are killing 1,600 Kentuckians a year.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, they're dying of heroin overdoses, maybe, but there was a lot of the addiction was created by prescription medicines back when they were being overprescribed. Now, this is outlined, but back to the original, the mediocre article that we were talking about in the first place, they call the opioid epidemic an emerging challenge. Kentucky passed House Bill 1 to try to limit our pill mills back in 2012. Now, I don't know how many years we have to die before this becomes something other than an emerging challenge, but we've been fighting this thing for a long time, and I am a little bit annoyed that this is now finally reached epidemic stage in other states when Kentucky has been fighting and losing this battle, you know, now for over a decade.
I mean, and I agree, Tony, but the thing that's really troubling as a Kentuckian, We have fought so hard to deal with the in general smoking topic, right? We're a state that grew tobacco, right? That's what our livelihood was founded on in some cases, some areas. And so here we have all this tobacco that it goes against our economic beliefs to try to do away with tobacco because smoking it gives you lung cancer. Now, here we go going down the marijuana path, and I'm disappointed that Kentucky believes that inducing that smoke back into your lungs for the benefit of improved health care.
Yeah.
Well, see, it just strikes me as only another way of bringing that we're like opening Pandora's box again, and we just about had the lid closed on it.
We were making some progress, albeit very slow. There is another bill to try to ban smoking on our schools in our school systems that is probably less likely to pass than the marijuana bill from our vantage point at this point in the legislative session. So, at any rate, I think you're right, Rick, and we are looking at hemp as a possible salvation for the small farms. Those small farms are pretty much, if you look at the way the tobacco barns are collapsing and the land is growing up, I think the small farms are gone.
Let's be honest.
Not going to come back.
What, 15 years ago, the federal buyout ended a lot of those farms.
Yeah, and
people took their money and ran.
And the next generation is not going to rediscover farming.
No.
That is not going to be a new and hot vocation.
But it doesn't mean that that's not, to some extent, still kind of baked into our heritage.
Okay.
And we'll make it easy.
Yeah, we will certainly. I think we are growing hemp, it remains to be seen how much marijuana we will be growing. But if we grow enough marijuana, particularly, to make our legislators, again, rise to its defense as it starts killing people in our state, I will be disappointed. And I'm sorry I'm so pessimistic about it. Like I said, maybe I have no right to be because...
It's Shelley's fault.
If she were here, she would talk some sense into both of us.
Well, not you. I'm not really being senseless right now.
Okay. Yeah, I've talked too much already. Let me go back to the emerging challenges so we at least can get through those. Violence in the communities. Now, I can't say there's not violence in the communities. I do not see that as an emerging Kentucky challenge right now, but all it takes is one person in a school system, doesn't it? One that's kind of interesting, medical surge capacity. That is, we have closed so many hospitals. We have limited our intensive care unit beds that if we had an epidemic, an Ebola-type situation to develop in the United States, we would have to begin rationing mechanical ventilators and ICU beds because we don't have the surge capacity. And particularly in the rural areas, it is acute. We would just give up on our older citizens because they don't have the ability to get to a metropolitan area to be hospitalized, and many of our hospitals are closed. So this is the chance you take living in a rural area. One I want you to comment on, Rick, is cyber threats in terms of challenges affecting rural healthcare.
Well, I mean, you know, cyber threats are, you know, unfortunately part of our life. I mean, you know, where there's valuable data, there's somebody trying to get it, right? And so they go through all different mechanisms. I mean, in some cases, they're going after money. In some cases, they're going after, you know, information that will allow them to make money. I mean, it is a real threat, Tony. And the thing is, the small rural hospitals have a harder time dealing with it because they can't afford, in some cases, the state-of-the-art gear.
I was going to say, you know, we obviously don't have the ability to defend ourselves, but we're really small potatoes.
Exactly. Well, but the thing is still, if you were to get into a hospital's medical record, you could probably get a database of names, social security numbers, addresses. You could probably find out if they have what kind of insurance they have, and that alone would set you up for a bunch of credit card scams. I mean, so there's valuable information to be gotten there. The problem turns into, you know, hacking is where there's never a time where we're actually ahead of the hacker. You know, we're always behind them. The question is how far behind them are we? And so you've ever heard the term zero day?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how you deal with zero day, which is actually the moment that it's first detected, you know, how long is your reaction time determines, you know, how fast you know, how your you know, the probability that you'll be protected.
problem in rural hospitals who can't afford the more modern gear with the more modern security subscriptions that have staff that are monitoring this. What happens is your time to 0 day turns into day one or day two or day three, and by then you may have 50, 100, 200 machines compromised, and it's just hard at that point to deal with.
Now, my impression is that the ransomware threat has diminished somewhat.
No, WannaCry is still around.
Okay.
I mean, these things are still around, and what you see is they've lowered the price of them. So it's not $37,000 to get your data back. It's $700. And what's happening is you see people worldwide are paying more ransoms. And it's actually, I mean, it's, I don't know if it's better or worse, but it's not gone.
Okay. So those are the emerging challenges. The recent challenges, healthcare delivery shifts, and I think they're meaning some of the newer things that they're trying out in the metropolitan areas. Behavioral health. The number, again, if you look at the incidence of mental illness in the rural areas, you look at the access to behavioral health in mental areas and it's, in rural areas, and it's just practically non-existent. I mean, my patients have to wade through paperwork and other people in order to see a mental health provider. Economic and demographic shifts, high cost of drugs. I mean, these are all hour-long topics.
We'll probably spend a minute or two in the next fractional portion because there's a whole lot there.
Meanwhile, we're going to sign off because Rick is pointing at the clock desperately.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I am Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Who is Alex Trebek show, the question to the answer. This popular game show host has been stricken with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Our sponsor for the final time then, the 8 key facts on pancreatic cancer. Number one, the pancreas lies behind the stomach, behind the colon, up at the upper part of the abdomen in front of the spine. It has two functions. One, it has an endocrine function. By that, I mean it makes hormone like insulin that helps you store sugar throughout your body. It also produces digestive enzymes which act locally. That's called an exocrine function. Those are different cells that do those two things. For that reason, there are really two main different types of pancreatic cancer. The neuroendocrine tumors grow more slowly than the exocrine, but the overall survival is not good for either one. Key fact number three, 55,000 Americans will be diagnosed. 45,000 Americans will die of pancreatic cancer this year. That puts it in the top five. Key fact number four, pancreatic cancer has the lowest survival rate of all cancers. 3 to 6% diagnosed survive for 5 years. Survival has improved for most cancers over the last 40 years, not for pancreatic cancer. None of the newer therapeutic modalities, none of the newer diagnostic tools have made a difference in the mortality rate. Key fact number five, it's the 10th most common cancer in the United States. It is the fourth deadliest. It will probably pass breast cancer for number three. Leaving only colon cancer and lung cancer that kill more Americans in the next 5 years. Key fact number six, not smoking, drinking alcohol in moderation, or why not drinking alcohol? Again, I cut and paste. I read what other people say. Maintaining a healthy body weight can reduce your risk. Risk increases with age, 90% over age 55, and average age is 72. Alex Trebek is 78. Key fact number seven, it is considered hereditary in a small number of cases, 5 to 10%, and that is if you have two or more first-degree relatives, mother, father, sister, brother, who had pancreatic cancer, or a relative who developed cancer before age 50, or a genetic syndrome associated with pancreatic cancer, then obviously it would be a familial cancer. Early diagnosis is the key. If you happen to find it before it develops major symptoms and you can operate and remove it, your survival goes up tenfold. It's almost always diagnosed too late. 80% of pancreatic cancers having terminal disease, average life expectancy 4 to 6 months. And key fact number eight, symptoms very vague and depend upon where in the pancreas, and the pancreas stretches across the top part of your abdomen in the back. in the back part of the abdomen. So abdominal pain 70% of the time, jaundice 50% of the time, nausea and vomiting quite frequently, and obviously it starts with weight loss. That's our 8 key facts on pancreatic cancer. Our sympathies to Alex Trebek, who now has it. We were talking about rural health challenges. We just kept that conversation going during the break, so that's why it took us so long to come back. Hopefully you've had a nice rest, and now you're ready for the third fractional portion of the show. We were talking about the 19 challenges to rural health care access, and again, I did not want to spend an inordinate amount of time on this because it's just a list, and then Rick and I get to spout off, and nobody wants to hear that.
Yeah, and as it turns out, after we talked through it on the break, we really weren't that interesting.
Yeah, I was not interested in Rick. He was not interested in V, and so I voted him off, and he voted me off, and so there's no one here left to talk about it. The emerging challenges, they mentioned the opioid epidemic, which has been around Kentucky for over a decade, violence in the communities, medical surge capacity, that is, if there were a need for additional hospital beds, where are you going to go in rural Kentucky to find those additional hospital beds? Cyber threats, and Rick corrected me, ransomware has gotten smarter. They have gotten more modest in their demands, but they are still around and they are still beating up on hospitals. Recent challenges, care delivery shift. We talked about behavioral health, a huge problem in the state of Kentucky. Economic and demographic shifts. What we mean by this is Kentucky is a poor state and our rural areas are noticeably more populated by senior citizens than our urban areas. The high cost of drugs is affecting us all. The regulatory burden is affecting just about everybody who tries to provide health care. I'll give you just a very brief example. It took me 3 times, and it got to be a running joke with me and with the staff. It turns out that a pull-up diaper is durable medical equipment. And so you have to use a durable medical equipment form. So I was ordering a package of pull-up diapers for one of my patients who is older. So the questions we had, first of all, what is the diagnosis that led me to order the pull-up diaper? Well, this patient is poops. They poop. Who knew? But they do.
But isn't there a diagnosis on why they do it uncontrollably?
Well, a disease, not really. I mean, they can control. They just can't get to the bathroom because it takes them a long time to get up and move around. They get their walker. They can't go very fast. They need a pull-up diaper. And so there's not. I mean, they're older, they're frail, but they don't have a colonic anything. So anyway, we just said, okay, we'll just say arthritis. And I don't know why you need a pull-up diaper for arthritis, but they can't get to the bathroom. Next question, is the patient able to operate the equipment? I mean, it's durable medical equipment. Are they able to operate? We said, yeah, I really think I
am. Thankfully, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. They said, when did you last see the patient for this condition? Mm. What condition? I mean, they they poop, you know. When was the
last? As their family doctor, yeah. The last time I saw them.
And the odd thing was it took me this form got returned to me twice. It took me 3 different times to get them what they needed to get some pull-up diapers, which you can buy for a really a modest price at the supermarket without any physician's authorization, no medical visits, and no forms. And so, you know, those are the sort of things that really set your teeth on edge, and that's regulatory burden. We'll keep going. insurance covers, Medicaid expansion, those are the recent challenges. And then the persistent challenges, low patient volume. It is true. You know, especially if you are a specialist, you simply cannot generate the volumes you need to keep your practice afloat in a rural area. The payer mix, by that we mean rural patients tend to be poorer. The more of them are on Medicaid. Medicaid does not pay as well as private insurance. And so that patient mix means you can't spend as much money on office furniture, on electronic medical records, on amenities, on staff as people in urban areas. Geographic isolation goes without saying. Workforce shortage. There are not many people who are anxious to get out to rural Kentucky. And then aging infrastructure because we don't have enough money from the other things to upgrade our infrastructure. And that, in a nutshell, are the things that the American Hospital Association feels are affecting rural areas. You can, if you want, insert your own emerging challenges to rural health care. We'll be glad to hear from that. Put that on our Facebook page, and we will respond to it. I am talking about mental health compensation right now.
You can be compensated for that?
Yeah. This is the thing started with an interview of Arthur Kaplan, who's the medical director of medical ethics, and Kaplan has done a lot of writing about the ethics of analyzing your genetics, of, storing that information, sharing that information, and so forth. But this is about mental health. Now, here's what happened. Anthem and Blue Cross plans, and Anthem is a repeat offender. We'll talk about that in a minute in terms of what they do to the healthcare providers, the people that are actually taking care of healthcare. Well, there were addiction recovery programs that were, we call it, out of network. That is, they did not give Anthem the customary 30 or 40% discount that Anthem demands for you to be in network. They said, no, we're going to charge. And their patients, their clients, would go to these people because they had no choice. These were the only providers they could go to. The providers would submit a bill, and Anthem, since they were out of network, Anthem, rather than paying the providers directly, which is what everyone else in the civilized world does, they paid the patient.
Great.
They give the patient a check for $130,000.
Wow.
A recovering addict, a check for $130,000, and they tell them, you should give this to your doctor.
Nice. You should.
You should.
Would it be criminal not to?
You're going to give them sums of money that they will not see in a year and tell them it is their duty to shift it over to the out-of-network service. Most patients are confused. Most try to repay the provider, but some don't. A group called Sovereign Health, one of their attorneys said Anthem sent the checks directly to the patients while they were in rehab. In other words, the rehab people were trying to get them off drugs and alcohol, and Anthem was sending them huge sums of money during their rehabilitation. Not after, but during.
Wow.
The other thing is then if they don't turn the check over, the doctors have to sue the patients. And that, you know, nobody wins when that happens.
Exactly.
Anthem's excuse is they say they're not doing anything illegal. And let me just say this to our healthcare fans. If someone tells you, I'm not doing anything illegal, they know darn well they're not doing the right thing.
Right. I mean,
There
may be some element of truth to what they're saying, but there is probably no moral truth.
Right. It is
or ethical truth.
The problem is the insurers, the American Hospital Insurance Plan spokesman said that the insurance companies don't have a contract or relationship in place with the hospital, the physician or care provider. Quite frankly, if I take my dry cleaning to the dry cleaners and they send me a bill, we have a contractual relationship. I mean, I understand that they didn't get their discount that they were looking for, but this right here actually may, inhibit the chances of these patients being cured by giving them vast sums of money at a time when they're very vulnerable. And it also, it's really designed
can
to irritate.
Can you imagine coming home to a $130,000 check on your porch?
I would have trouble with that. I mean, I am a physician, but I've never seen that sum of money in a single check.
Wouldn't that be kind of wild?
It would. And I think especially if I was at this point trying to battle an addiction, that is not helping. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely not.
At any rate, what they're trying to do is to force these people to go in network. They're saying, look, if you want to get money from us, then you're going to have to deal with us. You're going to have to give us a big discount, or we are not. You're going to have to get your money from your own patients. And Anthem, by the way, I mean, Anthem has had this history of really dirty dealing. This is when we talk about a national health care plan. I am worried about a national health care plan. I am not enthusiastic about it. I look at what our government has done. I don't trust them, but I don't trust the insurance companies. In fact, I don't trust anybody, which is why I'm sitting out here in rural Kentucky.
Right.
Yeah. So let's just get that out there. But at any rate, you may remember for several years, Anthem in particular, this came out October 30th, 2018 in Missouri. They got upset about it. But Anthem has decided they're going to look at their members when they go to the emergency room. After the person is discharged, their medical director is going to look back and see whether the person should have gone to the emergency room in the first place. And they're just simply not going to pay it unless their director thinks it's right. Now, there has been something called the prudent layperson. That is, if you are having pain in your chest and you're worried it might be your heart, it would be prudent for you to go to the emergency room and get that checked out.
Right.
And so when you come in and you say, I'm having chest pain, I'm worried about my heart, that has always been the standard, and the insurance companies were supposed to reimburse that. Well, now that is not necessarily your call anymore. You might feel that you're having chest pains, you need to get it checked out. It turns out that you have a little bit of pleurisy. You have some costochondritis, something like that. And then the medical director goes through and says, well, gee, you didn't need to go into the emergency room for a little bit of arthritis in your ribs. You should have stayed home. We refuse. And then the patient themselves are saddled with a bill. And then, once again, the hospitals have to go directly in. Back in October, they looked at this. Dr. F. Perry Wilson published this on Medscape. And about half of the emergency department visits, as best you could tell, could have been rejected by Anthem. We know if you call the ambulance, if it's a holiday or Sunday, if you're out of state, you're traveling, if you receive IV fluid surgery, if they give you an EKG, an MRI scan, or you get admitted to the hospital, Anthem will probably pay. But if you come in with chest pain and you go home and there's no IV, no EKG, then they probably will not pay, no matter what you thought you had, because it turned out you didn't.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, you put this together, Rick. Now this was old. The Anthem, the emergency room thing, was from last October. Back in February, they started doing this paying out to the patient rather than paying the provider. Then on March 6th, a judge has ruled that the United Health Group, their behavioral health unit, their insurer, their behavioral health insurers, they had violated their fiduciary duty. It was a 106-page decision. The company's guidelines were unreasonable and an abuse of discretion. They have been infected by financial incentives meant to restrict access to care. There is excessive emphasis on addressing acute symptoms and stabilizing crisis while ignoring the effective treatment of underlying conditions. United Health brought in experts into the courtroom. They were evasive and they were somewhat deceptive. And so he said that. Now, United Health, of course, with their billions of dollars, they'll keep appealing this till it goes away. They're not going to, you know, no judge is going to tell them how to run their business. But by the same token, between these efforts to restrict mental health access and the Anthem process of actually just paying the patients and not even paying for mental health access, no wonder the rural areas have trouble.
Right. I don't know. The whole thing seems messy. It just seems, I don't know, Tony. Why do you always end the show on stuff like this? You leave the audience hanging with no good answers to anything.
All right. You want an answer. I'm going to give you just an answer right now, right
here.
Well,
I can give you an answer. I just don't know what the question is.
Okay. Well, here is the answer, the question and the answer in a nutshell in less than 20 seconds. How about that? Okay. British research indicates that knee replacements and hip replacements, the over 70% of them, close to 80% of them, will last 25 years.
Excellent.
That is an excellent thing.
Excellent. That is marvelous.
Get us off the air, Mr. Marvelous.
Special thanks to, did you say Mr. Marvelous? I
do
love
you. Like
you. You know that? You're just great. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEX, thanks for listening to our show. And remember these facts about Alzheimer's dementia drugs and Health Matters from the AARP Public Policy Institute.
As many as half of all people ages 85 and older may have some form of Health Matters. As the U.S. population continues to age, the prevalence of health matters is expected to rise with a corresponding increase in related spending.
Current health matters drugs have shown limited efficacy. The two types of drugs that have been approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for the treatment of health matters symptoms. The clinical evidence indicates that these drugs may delay impairment for approximately 3 months to 12 months among certain adults with health matters, while other patients will not benefit at all.
The evidence supporting health matters drugs' effects on cognitive impairment is based on cognitive test results and not on real-world behavior. These drugs, in combination or separately, have not been shown to delay institutionalization, improve quality of life, or lessen caregiver burden.
There is some research that indicates that a small subset of patients may see a meaningful benefit from using Health Matters drugs, although such results remain subject to debate.
Despite the lack of clinical evidence supporting the practice, many clinicians continue to prescribe Health Matters drugs long-term at a substantial cost to patients and the overall healthcare system.
Whatever you do, do not take these Health Matters drugs lying down. Don't take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.